Okay, any path you know about?
As far as my father is concerned, I know very little of his childhood, except that he was born in Stratford-on-Avon, and he married Miss Virginia Bell, who lived at that time in Virgil, Ontario, which is just outside St. Catharines. He was a sergeant major in World War I, and very much a military man, both in outlook, discipline, and I remember sitting at the supper table, and that would be while I would be about 6, 7, somewhere in there. It was at Port Dalhousie. At those times, we used to get a battery down at the local garage charged up and bring it home and put it onto our radio set. And we'd listen to Amos and Andy at the supper table, which would be around 6 o'clock. And the station would sign off just around that time. And it would sign off with "God Save the King." And he would stand up at attention at the table. And one time we didn't, we kept on eating, and he knocked me off my chair. My mother, who bore twins, a twin sister and I, who I was born half an hour later, I'm the baby, died of pernicious anemia. And I was about 7, 8 days old when this happened. I have no recollection whatsoever of my mother. The first mother I remember was my dad's second marriage when we moved to Port Dalhousie. And that's quite hazy, although the events that happened were quite tragic and momentous at that time. My dad married and did not realize that she had cancer, and she died about 2 to 3 years later. And my dad at that time was working on the Wellenship Canal. You may note here that he was given the honor, and he is the man who opened the gates at Lock 1, Port Weller, for the official opening of the canal in 1932. And at that time, the longest lake freighter known, the SS Lemoyne, went through. And this was quite an honor. And I remember he had pictures framed of this event. My earliest recollections would be living with the Peppers in Seneca Street in St. Catharines. My dad boarded with them, I guess, and Mrs. Pepper, who at that time would be in her 60s, and Mr. Pepper, who was a private businessman, he owned a watch and clock repair, who did not do too well. He just managed to get food on the table. With my dad's income and board, at that time they had two children. One was Kay and the other was George. And all I remember is the George getting his first job with the Ontario Hydro, which was a very big break, especially in the time of just coming out of the Depression. And his income as well helped the Pepper family survive. We never had too much. The big treat, I remember, was breakfast, and we had puff wheat, which you got in these large bags. All the groceries were bought from a local store, which ran a bill. We used to just go down and say we wanted this and this, and they would put it on in a book. And at the end of the month, this was paid for. And many of the times I remember going down and buying a can of soup or soup bones or this type of thing, and just bare economics. We grew, we had a garden, and it was very important. We used to grow tomatoes and beans, lettuce, but not as we would grow it today, sort of. It turned out it wouldn't matter. This was very important as to our food supply. I have no memories of any mother in this, in that sense, although when my dad remarried and we moved to Port Dalhousie, that was a great experience for us because we changed schools and changed community, changed friends. I remember we attended church very religiously. My dad was sort of a leading citizen. He was on the Board of Education, and he was official of the Legion. He was a Shriner. I feared my dad. I didn't know him at all as far as companionship. All I knew that if I was wrong, I would be very severely disciplined. In those days, sense of right and wrong in a youngster was a minor problem because every adult expected young people and children to hew the line without reservation. The sense of right and wrong was never even discussed. The freedom of discussion or thought wasn't even entertained. You only spoke when you were spoken to, and you the only time I can ever remember going out with my dad was my sister and I. We took a trip to Jordan, Ontario, and I would be probably 6 or 7. And the only thing I really remember about that was that we had sauerkraut. And I loved it. And my sister hated it. But, and for excitement that day, we walked down and waved to the train as it went by. That was a, and the member of the train engineer waving back, and that was very exciting to me. But we never traveled or went anywhere. When I was about that age, my dad, for a treat, took us on the streetcar from Port Dalhousie, my sister and I, and this streetcar left Port Dalhousie and traveled along the Martindale Bridge. And if you know the Martindale Bridge, it's a very high trestle bridge crossing the old Welland Canal. What a thrill that was, my first streetcar ride. And we went into a big city of St. Catharines, and we went down to the Capitol Theater and saw Loretta Young in Bulldog Drummond Strikes Back. And from that day on, Loretta Young was my fairy princess. My relationship with my father was very distant. I don't ever remember him discussing anything with me other than right or wrong or what I did. Of course, when he came home from his work on the canal, we had a housekeeper, a German housekeeper, and she was the one that pretty well ran the house. And if I did something wrong, it would be left to my father when he came home to discipline me. And that was a frightening experience because I would be marched into a room, sat down on a chair, and then either given a good tongue lashing or a horse, he had a horse whip which he could lash me with. No, I don't really honestly say that there was any affection between us, and that applies as well to my sister, although she wasn't disciplined as severely.
Would you ever feel
No, I never had any thoughts regarding my father other than fear.
Was there ever a dramatic incident where you,
I remember about that age, it was probably early May, and there were still ice floes along the lake, and one of the greatest thrills for children at that time was to go down into the summer cottages, which sprinkle the shoreline, and we would play around there, and of course they'd be mostly empty, but the ice floes were still along the edge of the lake, and I remember falling in there, in the ice floe, and getting dragged out, coming home, and I had these horrible bloomer pants on, and my underwear evidently was so wet that it the stain from the pants got into it, and I got undressed, dressed again, and hid everything into a closet, and it was found a couple of days later, and I was strapped for that because I wasn't honest and I didn't tell them exactly what had happened. When the strapping was usually done with a belt strap. No, I wouldn't say it ever done in anger. I'd say it was done just, he felt the discipline was there to handle it. Another incident, it would be in the springtime, and in one of the fields, a friend of mine and I had flattened down a big square area about the size of a garage, and this was our little hideaway. And we decided that it would be nice to have some books and sort of a little treasure. And we each went home and got a book. And I went to my dad's bookshelf and picked out one book and took it down. And we put it in the field and we covered it over. And it was in a cardboard box. And this was our little secret hideaway. I don't even remember what was in the book. But it rained that night, and I woke up at night worrying about this book, and the next day I was there and the book had just been soaked and it was warped and the pages were in terrible shape, and so I put it back into the bookshelf because it was one of a series of books, and hoping that it wouldn't be detected, and it was, and I was whipped for that with a horse whip. The whipping. I don't know when you say how hard, but it left welts on your body. That's.
But wasn't that excessive in that day?
Oh yes, it was considered unreasonable by neighbors and friends and so forth. I had a couple who lived next door to us who were probably in their 60s who were very nice to us children, and used to give us cookies and cake, and they felt sympathetic for us. But I didn't realize that I was any different than anyone else. No, I figured that was the way life was, you know.
Did you get it from May?
No. Well, the only thing I remember about May is that I was about 13 before I won a fight. May was much bigger than I physically. Oh, I always resented my sister being bigger and stronger than I did. But, you know. But. Well, I would think of anyone dominant would be my sister at that stage. No, I wouldn't. It wouldn't mean a thing to me at all. Well, when a problem arose, and if there was anyone that we would go to, it would be our stepmother or our housekeeper at that time. Yeah. Which I might add that when I was about 12, when that's an interesting story, because my dad then married for the third time this housekeeper.
The German lady?
Yeah.
Oh, she did.
And this is, I remember, I just remember bits of that. The marriage was in the home.
How old were you when they got married?
I was about 12.
How long had she been with you?
About 4 years.
Did you love her?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. I don't have any fixed emotions regarding her.
No.
But I do remember them having the wedding in the house, and it was March. It was quite cold and quite sunny, nice bright day, and they both went outside to get their pictures taken. And possibly they were overheated and whatever, and they went out just in their dress suit, you know, dress and jacket and so forth, took the pictures. But whatever happened, when he went on their honeymoon to Niagara Falls, and they were in the Clifton House in those days, that was before the block was built, she died on their honeymoon of pneumonia. And my dad was so upset, which I didn't relate to directly, that he came home, and I remember him laying on the couch, just laying, not looking or saying, his eyes were open, but he didn't talk, he just laid on the couch, and neighbors came and looked after us, and particularly the neighbors next door, as I mentioned previously. And that happened, they were married, and she died on the Sunday night, on their honeymoon, and the very first or second day. He came home, didn't eat, didn't sleep, and he died at the following, that Thursday. So they're both married and dead within a week. And the doctors felt that this man had so much grief in his life that he just could not accept this last reversal, and just gave up living. And he was not a physically strong man in any case. He was gassed during World War I and was on a partial pension and had lung problems. So all the combinations together, they figured he just gave up living. My reaction, of course, is bewilderment. I didn't know what was going on. I knew neighbors were fussing around all the time. We were taken out of the home. I didn't communicate with my father in any way.
Yeah, anyway.
I don't even remember our father speaking to us after that point. Oh, I have a very vivid experience that has affected me all my life that I can mention. Would be when I was about five or maybe seven. We had moved to Port Dalhousie. My dad had remarried the second time, and when she passed away in about the second year, the body was put in a coffin in the front living room, and they put this purple tassel on the front door, and they changed all the light bulbs to red light bulbs in the upstairs and the hallways. And of course all the flowers, particularly the aroma of lilies and this type of thing, we were trundled off to bed, and before we went to bed we were asked to kiss mother goodnight. And I remember climbing into the coffin and leaning over and kissing what I thought was cold cement, and terrible feeling of fear ran through me. Then we were off to bed, and I remember rocking violently during that stages, and watching my mother walk into the room, who of course was dead. And
were you awake or asleep?
I'd be awake and asleep and restless and nightmarish, but I couldn't get away from it because there was always a red light glowing, and of course the house was just full of flowers. March. At my dad's funeral, he was buried from Winter Winters in St. Catharines, and why this was, I'm not sure, but his was a military funeral. And that affected me too in life. I thought I got through the funeral fairly well. And everyone was talking about these Sibley twins, and no one knew exactly what was going to happen to them. And no, they had, we thought that we would probably be going to a foster home. Although my dad had a little money set aside, because he was a pretty resourceful man as far as saving. This was set aside by a lawyer in St. Catharines, and we were made trustees of the state. And the Peppers, who were the people who looked after, who my dad boarded with after his first wife died, were named the trustees and executors, and they took us over and brought us back to St. Catharines, and we lived in Seneca Street with them. This, no doubt, although I didn't realize it, was very resented by Mr. Pepper, but the recourse was to survive on his income from watchmaking, and which was pretty well non-existent, so we helped with the income derived from our support to supplement the home sufficient that they could get by on, although they did resent bringing up the children. Mrs. Pepper,
did you feel that?
Was very the opposite. She was warm and loving, and well, I'll skip around, and
yeah, just do whatever.
I remember going back to the funeral. It was in Victoria Park in St. Catharines. At the extreme, about a mile and a half from there, was our first mother's grave. And my dad had made its own cross, a wooden cross, with her name Virginia, and had planted it on her grave. My second mother was buried in Port Dalhousie. My second mother's name was Lucy Green. Going back to the funeral again, I remember at the graveside, of course it was March as well, very, very cold. My dad was a mason, and the masons strolled by the coffin as it was sitting above ground, and they sprayed a sprig of heather or hemlock, and they all went by. And then a soldier played the last post, and they dropped the coffin. And at that point, I felt that my world had ended. Just to see this box disappear into the ground, not knowing where we were really going. That was it has made my reaction to funerals quite severe. Not as normal as most people. Death has no effect on me in that they come and go, and I've been pallbearers, and I've looked after so many funerals now, and it doesn't touch me in the same way as it touches my wife. Well, we stayed with the Peppers from about 1934, I guess.
When you were 12?
I'd be about 12, yeah. They were painful years, too, mainly because of my age, I guess, when I look back. We had a very strict principal at school. He took a particular interest in us because we were orphans and looked after, and everybody knew our story. And people generally were sympathetic with us. We went to St. Paul Street United Church, which was religiously kept. George Pepper, who now had moved out of this, and married a Marion Horton, who was a school teacher. She was lame, and it happened that Marion had taught me earlier, and this was a shock to me to think you'd marry a school teacher. But I remember George coming home every once in a while, and he had a car. And of course, to own a car in those days was really something tremendous. And he moved to Niagara Falls, and that was upsetting to the Peppers because they lost a son and they got married. But he helped support the family even then. This made Mr. Pepper a little more resentful. Kay had left before we came on the scene, and she had married and was living in Kingston. Those years were, in lots of ways, a very happy time because I lived in a very mixed neighborhood. We had Trojans, Pavliks, Tomziks, all sorts of people who I could relate with. They were happy, strong people. And I remember many of the hockey games we used to play on the street, and with magazines rolled up around your shins, and we'd play by the hour. And I remember in the summertime, roller skating was a very big thing. And I would do errands or anything, clean yards, or get the little money till I finally owned a pair of roller skates. And we would roller skate from where we'd play hockey on roller skates with a ball. And I remember that. I look forward to that tremendously. And we would roller skate all the way up to the city and back and think nothing of it, which would be, I suppose, 4 or 5 miles. And I was very aggressive in sports at school. I was not that good a student. I just didn't give a darn. And but I did show potential with all the roughness that I had. And I was class valedictorian for graduating out of grade 8.
How did you get that?
They picked me just because of my overwhelming charm, personality, and grit.
No.
I was very, I made friends with everyone, and I made enemies of very few, and I liked doing things. When I went into sports, we started a harmonica band, and I got that rolling, and I like to do everything except schoolwork.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did they think you were
misfit, or what? School was a very mixed up experience for me because I was first put into Central School, which Carmen's father was principal, and he immediately demoted me and sent me back to another school, St. Paul's Ward, and that is where I made friends with the Nicholson family, which is a Negro family in St. Catharines, and they had triplets, Faith, Hope, and Charity, and the two girls, Hope was the boy, and Faith and Charity were the girls. When they rolled their arms up and their biceps rolled around, no one touched them. And they were my protectors, because at that time, I was always getting in fights and never winning too many, but they would protect me.
So were you a fighter?
I don't know if I was a fighter, but I seemed to get in an awful lot of fights. I don't even know why these things happened. I remember going blocks out of my way so I wouldn't meet some guy who was going to beat me up, and sneaking in late and going over and saying to Faith, you know, so-and-so, and Faith says, I'll fix him.
Yeah.
But one day, life changed. A boy who I was really afraid of. Dramatic episode would be when Mrs. Pepper died, and again I was 16, and we're a set of twins. We didn't know where we're going. We still received supplementary income from lawyer Hetherington, who looked after the estate, but we couldn't get this money till we were 21. So we had an allowance for whoever would look after it. And when this happened, George Pepper came home and spoke to me and suggested that he had a friend who worked in a company that would be interested in my in helping me, and told me to go around and see him. This man turned out to be Mr. Kerry Baker, chief engineer of English Electric. And I'm a schoolboy who was delivering papers. That's the only income I had. Although I was a very important figure in collegiate, because I was in the band. I used to have white ducks and uniform, and played the bugle. And I met Mr. Baker, and he sat down and he said, I want you to take a paper route that I can get a list of the customers and keep tab on you, and then I'll meet you 1 year from today. Meanwhile, you stay in school. So I took this paper route. It was a Toronto Star. I had to get it on my bicycle. It was about 15 miles long. I worked at that time on Saturdays at Gilmer and Thompson, which is a grocery and meat department store. And I got $2 a day, and I started at 7 and I quit at 11. And I bicycled all over the city with meat and groceries. And I saved enough that I got a down payment on a bicycle, with $1 a week, cost $54. And I was never so proud of any possession in my life as this brand new bicycle, double bar, double fork, blue, big carrier. And, of course, it was the best that anyone had. After Mrs. Pepper died, Mr. Pepper died, that's right, Mr. Pepper died first, then Mrs. Pepper. When Mr. Pepper died, and Mr. Pepper died when I was about 16, and Mrs. Pepper, when I was about 17, 18, yeah. So I had to, I went back, a year had transpired from meeting Mr. Baker, and I went back, and he said that he would help me out by giving me a job, and I would start as a blueprint boy, but I had to enroll in the mechanical engineering course of ICS, and every exam would be sent to him for comment. If I would do these things, I could start. So I then had a job, and I was introduced to another woman who I very affectionately thought of, Mrs. Tripp, who lived on Dakota Street, and I was put in a boarding home. Meanwhile, my sister moved to Kingston to stay with Kay. So we were separated at that point. This is the stage where I made $10 a week, and my board was $9.85, and I had 15 cents to blow. It was a stage of Mrs. Tripp, I am sure, although I could never prove, did many things to help me out quietly. But I didn't meet their other boarders and her son, who was a foreman at a local machine and tool company, and they were great companions to me. the boys particularly who worked in the mill in town at that time were always taking me to ball games and hockey games, and I just enjoyed their companionship. They were much older than I. They would be real old men, about 25. They gave me all the facts and figures, and particularly women. They had the stories, and they could get drunk. And I remember one night staying up till 2 o'clock in the morning with I've forgotten the name of these two men who worked at Yale in town. Maybe about 25 hockey players. And they came in and dragged me out of bed and said, "Hey, we're going to show you something. Watch the window across." And at 2 o'clock, really late at night, this girl who lived in a house in the backyard had a bedroom window that faced our bedroom window. And we sat there for 2 hours in the dark waiting for her to come in, flick the lights on, and undress. And she undressed and put on quite a show, and these guys were going absolutely nuts. And at this stage, I was considered, I would think, quite safely a show-off. Not necessarily too likable, but I got into ball games, and I got into mixed ball games where we had a girls' league. And the first girl I ever remember getting interested into was a ball player. And she lived in Port Dalhousie. Her name was Pinder. I've even forgotten her first name now. But she was the first girl I was really interested in. And this was in my very early, my first year of work as Blueprint Boy. And I decided the only way to meet a girl reasonably well would be to go to a dancing class. So I enrolled into a dancing class, which is run by a Scotchman called Cameron, Scotty Cameron. And they had a, I learned the basic dance steps, foxtrot, waltz, and tango. And during that period, I met another young couple our age, who are also taking dancing lessons. And I found out after a few weeks went by that this particular girl companion was her brother. So it turned out that this girl was free, so I danced a lot with this girl and became infatuated. And mainly because she was the best dancer in the school. And when I and the one thing that attracted me to her, that she looked small and weak and needed protecting, and was and she had no airs, but was very shy. And of course this proved a challenge to my ego to break her down. Going to that classes was my best friend, Joe Stopka, Czechoslovakian boy, and we had some girlfriends we used to visit once in a while in Niagara Falls. And one day Joe says, "Why don't you pick up this girl, Lillian, and see if she'll go with us to Niagara Falls?" So Joe managed to talk his dad into getting a loan of the car, and I got my only Sunday suit and went over to the prestigious area of St. Catharines, Glen Ridge, and knocked on the door of 12 Geneva Street South to ask, and was asked in, and the lady who answered the door was one that I had met previously. She ran a second-hand store on St. Paul Street, and I had bought an ironing board from her. And she was very nice to me at that time, and I remembered her. And it turned out that they were the owners. And she welcomed me in, and I met Lillian's father for the first time. And I thought he was a very severe, gruff guy. And Lillian seemed to be getting her courage up just to come out with us. Very, very shy, didn't want to come out. But she came out, and we drove on our very first trip to Niagara Falls to visit these other two girls. And I drove her back. And that was our first date. I continued on at work, and from that point on, I wanted to continue my dance lessons, and I asked Lillian if she'd go to a show with me. We went to our very first show at the Balalaika, and from that point on, she was my dancing companion, although they were very painful years, because I remember another friend of the dancing class taking Lillian home one night, and I was incensed. A friend of mine turned out to be a real heel. He monopolized Lillian and danced all night with her, and I remember. We didn't kiss till about the 12th date, because it was absolutely unheard of. I was afraid to push things, because I would lose Lillian, and because she was most naive is correct. Matter of fact, I had to give her the facts of life that her mother didn't. Father turned out to be a tough person to deal with. Once I came in on a wet day with rubbers on, walked across the rug, and he screamed at me. But I remember Lillian's mother came to the rescue. Whatever they saw in me, I'll never know. But I, prior to my first job when I worked at Gilmer and Thompson, I remember I used to be called the Black Duck. And I don't really remember how I got that name, but everybody used to call me the Black Duck. Of course, I had a very heavy beard. I was very dark looking. I had the best case of pimples in the whole city. And I know every once in a while, they would, maybe once, twice a year, they would get together and we'd all go to Niagara Falls, New York to a stag show. And that's where I saw my first pornographic films, and dancing girls and all that sort of thing. And I remember being absolutely frightened out of my skull, because during the show, the police came in, stopped everything, took everyone's name, and I had visions of being put in handcuffs and my name appearing in the front page of the St. Catherine Standard and so forth. But evidently, this was just a routine thing. No guilt whatsoever. Yeah. It was being caught. During those early years when I used to ride on my bicycle, the new $54 one, down to General Motors, pick Lillian up and ride her home on the handlebars. Lillian paid us a good substantial part of her earnings to board, room board, and always had to work Saturdays to help around the house. She did the house cleaning and so forth, but the evenings are usually free. And I used to go over Saturdays and work along with her. I'd be cutting the lawns or taking down the storm windows. And that family became very important to me, particularly when I was invited to eat around the dinner table. Harley and I were the same age and did things together. And Lillian's father knew a good thing when he saw it, and I used to do an awful lot of work for him just to be around the house. But I was very odd at this family that they had brought up three children, never had any reversals in life, same mother and father, same companionship, same, no real problems. The only difference being was that their ethics and business ethics never really melded with mine. They would be more likely to look at a situation rationally and say, what's the best way to make a dollar? Where I would say, what's the honest or the good thing to do? They would take advantage of situations I wouldn't dream of. My sense of right and wrong, I think, no matter how painful it was, I owe to my father, because he never was unswerving in what was right and wrong, what was honest, what was truth. I think the thing I needed most at that stage and what I was going for was really, now that I can look back from the years, is someone who really loved and cared for me, and that I could depend on. And Lillian, to me, seemed to be true blue, and this was a goal. And I remember our very first trip out of town was such a thrill. We went to visit my sister in Kingston. We took a train from St. Catharines, and Kay, who had been her first husband, Don Eagle, treated us so well. We had such a great time and came home. And that was a little unusual for a young girl to travel away with a boy to a strange city like that. But the parents allowed it. As I got to know Lillian better, and she reciprocated any trust I gave her, we leaned on each other, because very heavily, the one gloom on the whole situation was the tremendous power her mother had over Lillian. Lillian could not make her mind up without discussing it with her mother first. And in fact, every time we had a date, I'm sure her mother knew exactly what went on and how it went on. And this became a problem. Her dad could care less, except that I think that he felt, well, if he gets married, that's one off that I don't have to worry about, because the Dipkars put the dollar bill first. One of the biggest thrills of my life at that time was just being associated with a family, and although I worked hard to deserve the inn every Saturday, I was given many outings with their family, such as going to movies, which I could not afford, and which they went to at least twice a week. And that was a thrill for me to go to a movie with them. And one day, I was invited to go with them to Muskoka. And that was really a big thrill, and I was part of a family circle, and we went up to Cache Lake, and we stayed at Makita Inn, which is in South Cache Lake, and all I remember is that it was a marvelous time. I enjoyed myself. And during that time, Lillian's father was most interested in buying a section of land on that lake, and he had chosen an island, Cranberry Island. And Lil and I went over in a canoe to Cranberry Island, which was only a mile or so away across the lake, and we had this whole island to ourselves. And I remember coming back at night, and that was a real lesson, because when it gets dark, the shoreline disappears, it gets jet black, and we nearly got lost coming back just a straight mile across the lake. But you didn't know if you're going straight or sideways or so forth. But that was a very happy experience. And that ended, of course, because about that time, I joined the Air Force. And the only reason I joined the Air Force was not that I was patriotic, was that I didn't want to get in the Army. So if there's a war on and I wanted to be part of it, I wanted to be in the Air Force. And I wanted to be a navigator. And Lillian didn't want me to be aircrew. And this carried on. But I got through my basic training in Galt as an aero engine mechanic, and was sent to the Canadian National Exhibition, which was their manning pool, as they call it, basic training. And I finally got my uniform and was sent to St. Thomas. And I worked extremely hard and graduated second out of a large group. I even forget how many was in it. It's rumored that the group was 125. But there were two reasons to graduate top, because the top three or four people got a choice of listings where the rest went overseas. And being in the top, I had a choice of the selection, and I took Jarvis, Ontario, number one bombing and gunning school. And I got that posting. At that time, Lillian joined me, and we lived in Port Dover. That's right, I'm not married yet, sorry. During my first few weeks in the Air Force at Jarvis, I was given my first airplane ride, and I was put up into the front beside the pilot, and I had worked on a crew that installed a new engine, and the policy was that on an engine installation, the plane has to go up for a test flight before it's handed over to the flying wing and proven. And on that test flight, there should be one party who worked on the engine. And I was on that crew, and I was selected to take this flight. I pleaded with the pilot, who was a New Zealander, sergeant in the New Zealand Air Force, if he would be kind enough to fly over St. Catharines and Niagara Falls, which by air miles would be only 40 or 50 miles from Jarvis, and he agreed. And so this was going to be a thrill. The sergeant on the Crown crew, I remember him kidding me, saying, "Give him a real flight, give him a thrill, this is his first trip." The pilot was very annoyed at being selected to make this flight, because this particular day, it was about January the 3rd, 4th, somewhere in the early part of the year, half the station was off for Christmas, half for New Year's. This particular half was all sitting around the camp enjoying themselves because flying was closed off due to weather conditions. But they thought it was safe enough to take one plane up for a test flight. So they went in and chose this man, and he was resentful because there was many other men that could have taken it. And he wanted to get up and get down as fast as possible. This, during the a corporal came out of the hangar and waved me out of the co-pilot seat, which I was very resentful, because that means I wouldn't see as well. There was another man sitting at the, there was four on this particular plane. The other man would be sitting at the radio receiver, which is in the middle of the aircraft. And the only position left, and I had to go, was sitting in the rear gun turret. Now the rear gun turret, you sit in a dome of plexiglass with two 303 machine guns sticking out, which means it's wide open where the guns are sticking out. And you can imagine what the weather was like on January the 3rd. And I buttoned up and I had my Air Force hat and flaps, and I was completely wrapped up for the frigid weather that would follow. And we took off. And much to my surprise, because I had just finished my basic training, he didn't warm the engines up. And it spluttered and stuttered, and we got to the end of the runway, and I thought, well, he will certainly stop the plane, and he'll let the engines heat up, and he'll warm them up and check them out, and this would be a normal flight. But instead of that, he just wheeled it onto the runway without even stopping and gave it full throttle, and off we went. And flying in a Bolingbrook is an experience in itself, because you just lumber along that runway, it seems, for minutes. And you're just picking up speed slowly, and it just lumbers and lumbers. You can't hear for the noise of the engines. And we lifted off. And we just got up in the air about 80 feet, and one engine cut out, and the wingtip went straight down to the ground, and we were flying sideways over the field. And I thought it was absolutely marvelous, because the trees not only stood up, they turned sideways, and I was thrilled out of my mind. I thought, what a thrill. And it didn't dawn on me that the engines had stopped. And it caught on, and we climbed possibly 300, 400, or 500 feet, and both engines stopped. And the plane went into a complete dive and went straight into the ground. It absolutely buckled, and I was in, and the fuselage snapped in half. I was in the strongest structural section of a plane, being in a round ring of channel steel, which the guns were mounted on, which was on the outer tail end of the plane, where it buckled in half. The front part was demolished. The plane split open, and I was hung into this ring section. I don't know if I passed out or came to or whatever. All I heard was a sizzling sound like frying bacon. And looking around, I had no idea that the problem was as serious as it turned out. My biggest concern was to get out of the plane, run to the front of the plane, shut the switches off the engine to make sure no flames would start, and I couldn't get out. I was trapped. And I managed to get through about a 12-inch hole eventually, and crawled out on my stomach, and saw there was no plane at the front. There was no pilot. There was no co-pilot. There was just nothing. The engines were miles away in fields. But I could see the pilot laying in the field, a quarter of a mile away from the plane. I ran across the snow over to the pilot, and his skull had been severed directly above his eyes, and his head laying completely open. His arms were ripped off, his legs were ripped off, except one, and I sat down and gave this man first aid as he was still twitching. And I found that it couldn't help him, so I then tried to find the corporal who was sitting in my original seat. And we finally found him wrapped up in the piping of the aircraft under one wing. And the biggest portion that could be recognized was a clump of hair, nose, and so forth. He was absolutely mangled like
through a meat grinder. The man who was at the radio seat, which was just at our point where it buckled, was unconscious, and the radio set had come off, hit him in the face.